Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Pleading Requirements Post-Decision Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 18, 2009, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Ashcroft v. Iqbal. In this case, the court considered whether FBI Director Robert Mueller and former Attorney General John Ashcroft are entitled to qualified immunity against allegations that they knew of or condoned racial and religious discrimination against individuals detained in the wake of the September 11th attacks. In a 5-4 decision delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held that Iqbal pled insufficient facts to show that petitioners Ashcroft and Mueller implemented their policies for the purpose of discrimination. Furthermore, the court stated that the Second Circuit should decide in the first instance whether to remand to the district court to allow Iqbal leave to amend his deficient complaint. To discuss the decision, we have New York University School of Law Acting Assistant Professor of Lawyering, Jody S. Balsam. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Balsam.
On May 18, 2009, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Ashcroft v. Iqbal. The 5-4 ruling held that Javed Iqbal, a Pakistani Muslim who was arrested after the September 11th attacks, may not sue John Ashcroft, the former Attorney General, or Robert Mueller, the current FBI director, for abuses he says he suffered in a Brooklyn detention center. Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority and joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, held that Iqbal failed to plead sufficient facts to show that defendants implemented their detention policies for the purpose of discrimination. Notable for many reasons, the majority decision in Iqbal has launched debate and commentary, principally over its establishment of a heightened pleading standard under Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and its implications for Bivens and supervisory liability claims. At first glance, Ashcroft v. Iqbal was a case about national security. In the aftermath of September 11th, the FBI and other federal agencies pursued a massive investigation, including questioning over 1,000 individuals suspected of involvement in the attacks or in terrorism in general. Over 750 of those individuals were held on immigration charges, and 184 of those were considered, quote, of high interest, end quote, to the investigation. The high-interest detainees were held under restrictive conditions that prevented them from communicating with other prisoners or the outside world. Plaintiff Javed Iqbal was one of these detainees. A citizen of Pakistan, he was arrested in November 2001 on charges of identity fraud in connection with his immigration status and eventually placed in the special unit of the Federal Detention Center for High-Interest Detainees. Iqbal ultimately pleaded guilty to the criminal charges, served a term of imprisonment, and was deported to Pakistan. He then filed a Bivens action in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York against detention center officials with whom he had direct contact and also Justice Department, FBI, and Bureau of Prison officials at various levels, and at the top of the hierarchy, John Ashcroft, Attorney General at the time, and FBI Director Robert Mueller. The case before the Supreme Court concerned only these last two defendants. The 21-count complaint does not challenge Iqbal's arrest or the time he spent confined in the general prison population. It focuses on the time he spent in the special housing unit where he was confined to his cell for 23 hours a day and spent the remaining hour outside, shackled, and heavily guarded. Iqbal also alleges various instances of misconduct by prison guards, including physical and verbal abuse, strip searches, denial of medical treatment, and refusal to allow him to observe religious practices or to communicate with his lawyers. However, as to the two petitioners, Ashcroft and Mueller, the complaint alleges essentially three things. One, the FBI, under Mueller's direction, arrested and detained thousands of Arab Muslim men as part of its investigation of the events of September 11th. Two, the policy of holding some of these detainees in highly restrictive conditions of confinement until they were cleared by the FBI was approved by Ashcroft and Mueller. Three, Ashcroft and Mueller knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject Iqbal to harsh conditions of confinement as a matter of policy, solely on account of his religion, race, and or national origin. These allegations purport to state violations of the First and Fifth Amendments to the Constitution. For for which Iqbal seeks damages under the Supreme Court's 1971 decision in Bivens versus six unknown federal narcotics agents. Before the case moved forward to discovery, Ashcroft, Mueller, and other officials who were sued asked the federal judge to dismiss the lawsuit entirely, claiming, among other arguments, that as government officials they had qualified immunity to the lawsuit. The district court denied the defendant's motion to dismiss, finding that the complaint had offered sufficient information to permit Iqbal access to pretrial discovery to further substantiate his claims. The district court also suggested that discovery might be cabined to limit the burden on defendants and allow them to pursue their qualified immunity defense at the summary judgment stage. The defendants were permitted to take an interlocutory appeal to the Court of Appeals to the Second Circuit, which affirmed the district court's rulings on all counts but one, sustaining all but the procedural due process claim. In so ruling, the Second Circuit applied the Supreme Court's then freshly minted 2007 decision in Bell Atlantic Corp. versus Twombly. In Twombly, the court dismissed an antitrust complaint after construing the pleading standard of Rule 8 to require that a complaint contain allegations sufficient to render the claim plausible. The Second Circuit concluded that this new plausibility requirement applied in all civil cases, and that it was satisfied in Iqbal's case by the allegation that Ashcroft and Mueller condoned and agreed to the alleged discrimination against Iqbal. One judge on the Second Circuit panel, the Honorable Jose Cabranes, filed a concurring opinion urging the Supreme Court to weigh in on the relevant pleading standard and whether it was appropriate to subject high-ranking government officials to the burdens of discovery on the basis of a complaint as nonspecific as Iqbal's. Although other officials involved sought to appeal to the Supreme Court, only the petition for review by Ashcroft and Mueller was heard by the justices. The Supreme Court reversed the Second Circuit, holding that Iqbal's complaint was deficient. The opinion first confirms that the Second Circuit had subject matter jurisdiction to review the interlocutory order of the district court under the collateral order doctrine. This doctrine allows review of prejudgment orders that finally determine claims of rights separable from and collateral to rights asserted in the action, when those claims would otherwise be effectively unreviewable on appeal from final judgment. An order denying qualified immunity meets this standard and is entitled to immediate review because the defense is intended to provide protection not just from liability, but also from the burdens of responding to a lawsuit. The court then turned to the two questions certified for review. First, whether a conclusory allegation that a high-ranking official knew of, condoned, or agreed to subject a plaintiff to allegedly unconstitutional acts, purportedly committed by subordinates, is sufficient to state a Bivens claim against those officials in their personal capacity. Second, whether high-ranking government officials may be held personally liable for the allegedly unconstitutional acts of subordinates on the ground that, as high-level supervisors, they had constructive notice of the discrimination allegedly carried out by such subordinates. The court's analysis begins by examining the elements a plaintiff must plead to state a claim under Bivens. Bivens created an implied private action for damages against federal officers alleged to have violated an individual's constitutional rights. Cases interpreting Bivens clarified that it does not support suits brought under a theory of respondeat superior. In other words, government officials may not be held vicariously liable under Bivens for the unconstitutional acts of their subordinates. Bivens therefore requires Iqbal to plead that Ashcroft and Mueller, through their own individual actions, violated the Constitution. Thus, Iqbal is required to allege that Ashcroft and Mueller acted with discriminatory purpose, defined as something more than an awareness of or acquiescence in the consequences. In the court's words, Iqbal, quote, must plead sufficient factual matter to show that Ashcroft and Mueller adopted and implemented the detention policies at issue not for a neutral investigative reason, but for the purpose of discriminating on account of race, religion, or national origin, end quote. That is, they took these actions because of and not in spite of Iqbal's status as an Arab and a Muslim. The court decided that the complaint's conclusory allegations failed to meet this standard. And this is where we get to the meat of the decision. The Iqbal decision confirms that the Twombly plausibility standard for evaluating pleadings applies in all civil cases. The court further explains that the new standard has two principal implications. First, the tenet that a court must accept as true all of the allegations contained in a complaint is inapplicable to legal conclusions. Threadbare recitals of the elements of a cause of action supported by mere conclusory statements do not suffice. Second, only a complaint that states a plausible claim for relief survives a motion to dismiss. The court observed that applying the plausibility standard is a context-specific task that requires the reviewing court to draw on its judicial experience and common sense. To understand the distance the court has traveled from previous conceptions of federal civil pleading standards requires going back to the original language of Rule 8. For over 70 years, Rule 8 has stated that a federal civil complaint, quote, must contain a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. Rule 8 supplanted previous hyper-technical code pleading rules. But as the court emphasized in Twombly, nothing in Rule 8's requirement of a short and plain statement suggests that plaintiffs could dispense with factual support for the relevant allegations. And the court faulted its 1957 decision in Conley v. Gibson for creating that misimpression. In Conley, the Supreme Court interpreted Rule 8 as precluding the dismissal of a complaint for failure to state a claim, quote, unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim which would entitle him to relief. Basically, the expansive Conley standard allowed plaintiffs to file complaints that contain nothing but legal conclusions, and then, when challenged, they could ask the court to imagine facts not found anywhere in the complaint in order to defeat a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. Commentators began to call this, quote, notice pleading, a phrase found nowhere in Rule 8. The Conley no set of facts approach to Rule 8 effectively neutered the provision of another federal rule of civil procedure, Rule 12b-6, that provided for immediate pre-discovery dismissal of inadequately pleaded complaints. With the advent of modern discovery practices, the Conley theory of pleading had unanticipated harsh results. As the court noted in Twombly, the problem of discovery abuse and the heavy costs it can impose on litigants can push defendants to settle even the weakest claims. By eviscerating the 12b-6 motion to dismiss, Conley removed the most effective tool to counter non-meritorious lawsuits. Noting that the district courts have had only modest success in supervising discovery to check its crushing costs, the Twombly court officially retired Conley's no set of facts language to revive the motion to dismiss. The court returned to an interpretation of Rule 8 that allows the district courts to require some specificity in pleading. In keeping with the principles of Twombly, the Iqbal court set forth a two-pronged approach for evaluating a pleading. First, a court should identify all allegations that are no more than conclusions and exclude them from the assumption of truth. Second, as to well-pleaded factual allegations, a court should assume their veracity and then determine whether they plausibly give rise to an entitlement to relief. Applying this test to Iqbal's complaint, the court concluded that the allegation that Ashcroft and Mueller condoned discriminatory conduct was nothing more than a formulaic recitation of the elements of a constitutional discrimination claim. As such, the allegations are conclusory and not entitled to be assumed true. The court continued, to be clear, we do not reject these bald allegations on the ground that they are unrealistic or nonsensical. It is the conclusory nature of Iqbal's allegations, rather than their extravagantly fanciful nature, that disentitles them to the presumption of truth. The court next considered the factual allegations in the complaint. Essentially, that in the weeks after 9/11, Mueller directed the arrest and detention of thousands of Arab Muslim men, and Ashcroft and Mueller both approved the restrictive detention policies applied to some of these detainees. The court assumed the truth of these allegations and observed that they were consistent with the purpose to designate detainees of high interest because of their religious or ethnic background. But it found those allegations implausible because of an, quote, obvious alternative explanation, end quote. That was a, quote, more likely, end quote, motivation for the post-9/11 detention policies. Given that the United States had been attacked by an organization led by and composed of Arab Muslims, it was no surprise that the people detained would be disproportionately Arab and Muslim, not because of prejudice against Arabs and Muslims, but because that is where the leads would take the authorities. The more plausible explanation for the disparate impact on Arab Muslims was the non-discriminatory intent to detain aliens who were illegally present in the United States and who had potential connections to those who committed terrorist acts. To plausibly suggest otherwise, that is, to attribute a purposeful policy of discrimination to Ashcroft and Mueller, required Iqbal to plead specific facts showing their complicity. The court notably rejected Iqbal's argument that concerns about preserving the qualified immunity defense could be met by instructing the district court to cabin discovery in anticipation of a summary judgment motion. The court refused to calibrate the sufficiency of pleadings according to the controls placed upon the discovery process. The case was remanded to the Second Circuit for further proceedings, including consideration of whether to permit Iqbal to amend his complaint. Justice Souter, who wrote the Twombly decision just 2 years earlier, dissented in Iqbal, joined by Justices Stevens, Ginsburg, and Breyer. In Souter's view, the Iqbal majority misapplied Twombly and improperly addressed the scope of supervisory Bivens liability. He reads the court's opinion as effectively eliminating supervisory liability because it implies that even if Ashcroft and Mueller knew that their subordinates were denying prisoners their constitutional rights and condoned it, they would not be legally responsible. The court does this, Souter wrote, even though Ashcroft and Mueller had conceded that they could be held liable on a theory of knowledge and deliberate indifference. By overriding that concession, the court denies Iqbal a fair chance to be heard on that question. Given this concession, Justice Souter would find that Iqbal's complaint satisfies Rule 8's pleading requirements. Complaints should be allowed, Souter said, even if a savvy judge doubts that the alleged facts can be proven. Justice Breyer dissented separately in Iqbal to underscore a key point made by the Second Circuit and urged by Iqbal. When a government defendant asserts qualified immunity, the trial court responsible for managing the case can structure discovery in ways that diminish the risk of imposing unwarranted burdens upon high-level public officials. Justice Breyer thus would leave the current system intact. Reactions to the Iqbal decision were swift and fierce. Most academics were appalled by the retreat from notice pleading. Practitioners, especially on the defense side, were relieved at the effort to insert some rationality into a litigation system run amok. And Senator Arlen Specter introduced legislation entitled the Notice Pleading Restoration Act of 2009 that, if enacted, would overturn Twombly and Iqbal and restore the standard for dismissing complaints under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 12b-6 and 12e to the No Set of Facts standard first announced in Conley v. Gibson. Commentators also expressed confusion over whether Iqbal implicitly overrules Swierkiewicz v. Surima, a 2002 Title VII case in which a unanimous Supreme Court approved a complaint that alleged that the plaintiff was fired because of his age and national origin. The Swierkiewicz court specifically rejected the argument that it should not allow lawsuits based on conclusory allegations of discrimination. Notably, the court did not ask, back in Swierkiewicz, whether there was an obvious alternative explanation for firing the plaintiff, such as the possibility that he was not as good at his job as the workers retained. Given that Iqbal, like Swierkiewicz, assessed the adequacy of factual allegations of discrimination, it is difficult to see how Swierkiewicz remains good law outside of its narrow holding that the specific complaint in that case was legally sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss. Beyond the procedural issues, the Iqbal decision has implications for future Bivens claims. It is well established, even before Iqbal, that there is no respondeat superior liability as to entities or supervisory officials under Bivens. A supervisory officer can only be liable for his own misconduct. But all of the courts of appeals previously had recognized to varying degrees that supervisory liability could attach where there was underlying unconstitutional conduct on the ground and a supervisory official knew about the misconduct and acquiesced in it or condoned it or failed with deliberate indifference to take steps to correct or prevent the misconduct. This is what Iqbal attempted to plead, and Mueller and Ashcroft both conceded that they could be liable if they actually knew about underlying constitutional violations and took no steps to halt or correct the misconduct. The majority brushed aside this concession and insisted that a supervisory official also must have acted with a discriminatory purpose. Mere knowledge of constitutional violations on the ground and failure to respond to them is not enough. The officer must have failed to respond precisely because the individual, in Iqbal's case, was an Arab Muslim. In conclusion, before Twombly, some courts held that all a pleading had to do was to put a defendant on fair notice as to what the lawsuit would try to prove. Twombly changed that, and Iqbal amplified it. Regardless of its ultimate limits, Iqbal is one of the Supreme Court's most significant decisions in recent memory, already cited in literally thousands of lower court cases, according to Westlaw Keysight, just in the last 4 months. Going forward, Rule 12b-6 motions will be used more frequently to challenge claims before the expense of discovery begins to mount. In many cases, the district court will allow the plaintiff to amend a complaint deemed deficient under Twombly and Iqbal But among those cases, there will be plaintiffs who will have difficulty pleading specific facts to overcome the deficiencies. Moreover, even if the plaintiff is successful in filing a valid amended complaint, the defendant will benefit from having more specific allegations to defend and with which to define the limits of discovery. Iqbal is clearly the new touchstone for initial motion practice in civil lawsuits.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.